Today at Reader's Corner, Elizabeth Colbert, winner of the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction for The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For as long as humans have walked the earth, we've been making changes to it, oftentimes with little or no comprehension about the far-reaching consequences of our actions. But in her award-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, Elizabeth Colbert opens our eyes to the powerful and possibly catastrophic mass extinction unfolding right in front of us. Ms. Colbert won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction for The Sixth Extinction, which is now out in paperback. She traveled the globe to tell the fascinating and important story of how our planet is under assault and why we should all be concerned. Ms. Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a two-time National Magazine Award winner, and the author of the 2006 bestseller, Field Notes from a Catastrophe. She joins us by phone for this interview. Elizabeth Colbert, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
So how did we get into this business of numbering the extinctions on the planet? And tell us about the sixth.
Well, the so-called Big Five that preceded the sixth, how's that, are all pretty, stand out pretty strongly in the fossil record. So I guess you would say that's how we got into the business of numbering them.
Uh-huh.
And then the question of whether we are now in a sixth mass extinction, we obviously don't have a fossil record to look at for that. So for that, we have to look at extinction rates that we can measure in terms of species that we knew were here that aren't here anymore. And in fact, there was just a few days ago a paper looking at precisely this, you know, what do we know about extinction rates over the last couple hundred years and how do they compare to historical extinction rates? And that paper came out pretty strongly on the side of, you know, yes, indeed, we're seeing really, really high extinction rates right now on par with what you would have seen if you were around, you know, during those previous mass extinction events.
And obviously, throughout your book, you refer to climate change. That's clearly one of the key factors here driving this extinction.
Well, I should be a bit careful here. I just want to say that climate change is, we're sort of in the very early stages of climate change. The climate is going to continue to change for, you know, quite a long time, depending on how long we continue to burn fossil fuels. But even afterwards, because it takes a while for the planet to reach what scientists would call a new equilibrium. And so we're in the very early stages of that, and it's very tough right now to attribute any extinctions to climate change. We see a lot of species are on the move because of climate change, but we don't have any species yet that we can definitively link their extinction to climate change. So those extinctions are really much more in the projected range, what's going to happen over this century. But in terms of extinctions that we've actually already seen, of which there are unfortunately many, I don't think we can attribute, as I said, any of them yet to climate change.
But you do seem to think, as I read your book, that obviously humans are playing a key role in this extinction event.
Well, they're not just playing a key role. I mean, they're playing the role. You know, so
right.
The question is, would we have seen really any of these extinctions without human activity? And I think the general consensus is, among scientists, would be, well, you know, maybe one or two, but the vast majority of these extinctions of the last, you know, several hundred years would not have taken place without human activity. So, you know, what are the big drivers of extinction? What human activities have been the big drivers of extinction, you know, up till now, and what are they going to be the big ones going forward? Well, up till now, they've been things like, you know, clubbing animals over the head. You know, we're pretty good at that. We're good hunters, and we've definitely just simply hunted some animals out of existence. Then we are also very good at, we've moved a lot of things around the world. We have brought in predators, for example. That's a very, you know, easily understood example where we humans bring in, you know, cats and rats and animals like that to places where they weren't didn't exist before. They are also very good hunters, and they go out and hunt, in many cases, native species. We've lost a lot of birds, for example, that way, ground-nesting birds, flightless birds, because they're just not, we're not prepared for that sort of predator. So introduced species are a big driver of extinction. Just changing the land, right? And everyone has heard stories of, cutting down the Amazon, but when Europeans came to America, they cut down, most of the forests of the eastern seaboard. There were a couple of extinctions that resulted, from that, probably. So those are the sorts of things that have been big drivers of extinction to date. Now, when we look forward, as we discussed, climate change is very likely to be a big driver of extinction because we are compelling species to move to track the climate, but we are not necessarily giving them any place to move to. And another biggie that's perhaps underappreciated, which is the sort of flip side of global warming, is a phenomenon called ocean acidification, which just refers to what happens when carbon dioxide dissolves in the oceans. And when we put carbon dioxide in the air, a lot of it ends up in the oceans very quickly. And it dissolves to form an acid, carbonic acid, and that is changing ocean chemistry really, really rapidly. And that also is very likely to become a major driver of extinction.
You mentioned climate change again. You picked up an ally here, or that is those who are concerned about climate change and its impact on the ecological landscape. Pope Francis came out pretty strongly a couple of weeks ago in this regard. Was that any kind of a shock to you?
Well, that encyclical, his encyclical on climate change and on the environment more broadly, that, it wasn't a shock in the sense that he has been working on that for a year and everybody knew that it was coming down the road and that it was going to be a pretty strong statement, I think. But I think maybe people were surprised. I don't want to say I was terribly surprised, but maybe some people were surprised at how strong it was. It was really a very powerful statement. There was, probably something in there for all sorts of different groups of people to take issue with, but it was a very powerful statement of his concern and from a moral and ethical perspective of concern for what we are doing to the planet, to the other species, with whom we share the planet, and the effects that this environmental harm has on humans. Especially, Pope Francis was really calling attention to the impacts that climate change, for example, is going to have on, very vulnerable people. People are already living at the very edge of survival.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the examples that you cite in your book. You lead off with a tale of amphibian loss, specifically the golden frog. And if you could tell us a little bit about what's happened there. I don't think it's just the golden frog, but what are we looking at here?
Well, that is a really interesting and tragic example. And amphibians, so amphibians are frogs and toads and salamanders, have the really dubious distinction of being considered right now the world's most endangered whole class of organisms. And one of the big drivers behind the extinction of amphibians is a fungal disease that seems to have been very, very rapidly transported all around the world on some kind of frog. We haven't been able to decide what kind of frog, but on some kind of frog that people transport around the world, either for food, perhaps, or for medical purposes. Because actually some frogs from Africa were used in early pregnancy tests, which is an interesting fact that people don't remember anymore, but they were, and they were moved around the world for that reason. So that's a possible sort of vector for this fungal disease. So this fungal disease showed up in many different parts of the world pretty much at the same time and started to just race through amphibian populations. And the story that I tell at the start of the book is about how biologists in Central America could actually watch this fungus. They identified it as a fungus sort of in the late 90s, early 2000s, and by the mid-2000s, they had gotten good enough so they could actually watch this fungus as it spread, and they realized that it was going to hit this area in central Panama that's home to this really spectacular frog called the Panamanian golden frog, which is this very bright yellow frog, really, really beautiful animal. And they rushed to take some of those animals out of the rainforest to preserve, you know, just this remnant population. And they didn't have a place to put them, so the frogs ended up spending a couple months literally in a hotel. So that was sort of a funny story about a very, very tragic set of occurrences. And now that frog, the Panamanian golden frog, is considered extinct in the wild, though it does still exist in some zoos and in this facility that they finally built in central Panama.
Wow, that's an interesting story. Frogs in hotels.
Yeah, it's sort of a charming story and a very sad story.
So it sounds like this fungus, I mean, it's difficult to attribute that to a human cause, but I suppose what you're getting at here is that as humans move so rapidly and quickly across the globe, funguses like this spread as they take their frogs with them?
Yes, exactly. I mean, one of the reasons why people are scientists, I shouldn't say just people, but scientists who study this are very convinced that this fungal disease, you know, had to have been spread around by people is that, as I said, it appeared in really, really wildly, you know, disparate parts of the world, Australia, South America, North America, Europe, at around the same time. So if I'm a fungus, right, and you can evolve a very potentially fatal fungal pathogen, that's not, you know, inconceivable in the course of evolution, but that fungus would not be able to just hop across an ocean on its own. So you have to kind of infer that people moved it around the world somehow, and very sophisticated genetic analyses are done to sort of, you know, try to trace the evolutionary history of this fungus. And it's actually been rather frustrating for scientists because they haven't exactly been able to pinpoint, you know, sort of what the originary, you know, place was where this fungus developed. Now there's another story, a not at all dissimilar story, unfortunately, of a fungus that's killing bats. It probably has not yet reached as far west as Idaho, but it is spreading west across the country. It's now in, I think, pretty much half of the states in the U.S. And that, you can identify where it entered the U.S. It entered not far from where I live in upstate New York and has spread from there. And that has been traced pretty definitively, once again, using this genetic analysis back to Europe.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. I'm Bob Kustra, and my guest today is Elizabeth Colbert, author of The Sixth Extinction and Unnatural History. So let's move to the loss of a species that is, in fact, attributed to human cause, that is, the loss of habitat that is caused by humans clearing ecological landscapes of one kind or another, the Sumatran rhino you talk about in your book.
Yeah, that's a very a really sad story that I think everyone can relate to, because rhinos are really fantastic creatures, and they're actually, though they're rather, they can be rather ferocious looking, you know, with those one or two horns, depending on the species, on their noses. They're actually very, very gentle and shy creatures. They're, you know, herbivores. They just eat grass and leaves. And I got to spend a lot of time hanging out with one of the last Sumatran rhinos in the world, whose name was Suchi, who was born at the Cincinnati Zoo, and they were at a moment when people, you know, realized that the Sumatran rhinos are probably down to their last 100 or so individuals. There's a tremendous amount of concern about that, and Suchi was hoped was going to breed. They were actually getting so desperate that they were hoping to breed her with her own brother because there are so few Sumatran rhinos left. But a very sad postscript to the story I tell in the book is that Sushi herself has since died, so obviously is not going to be producing any more Sumatran rhinos. So there's a real, real race against the clock. This is one of these species that has gotten to, you know, the absolute edge of extinction, and the question of whether it can be brought back from the edge is very, very unclear. But there are very few of these rhinos left in the wild, where, while, you know, a couple hundred years ago there were, you know, probably a million more, maybe more, roaming around, you know, Southeast Asia.
You know, one of the things I was really surprised to hear in reading your book was the case of the Cincinnati Zoo not figuring out what these rhinos ate, and they were feeding the rhinos hay. Did Sushi die a natural death? Did she die prematurely? And did it have anything to do with the fact that they couldn't figure out what to feed this animal?
Well, what happened was that they, you know, realized that these populations were really, really low. They took a bunch into captivity in Malaysia and in Indonesia, and some of them got sent to the U.S., to zoos in the U.S., and mistakes were made. A lot of mistakes were made. So humans have not, even in their very, very desperate, and I would say, you know, well-meaning attempts to save this species, have not done well by them. So mistakes were made. They were made in the care in Indonesia, and they were made in the care in Malaysia, and they were made in the care in the U.S. And in the U.S., one of the big mistakes was the diet, which had not, as you say, they hadn't really figured out that they cannot live on hay, though they are, you know, grazers and browsers. They really need certain kinds of leaves, apparently. And so that was corrected, and the Cincinnati Zoo was spending a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to bring in these ficus leaves, you know, every week for the rhinos to eat. So, and, you know, one of their rhinos at the Cincinnati Zoo lived to be very, very old, but Suchi died from this weird condition where iron builds up and you sort of die of iron poisoning. And it may have been a genetic thing. Her mother died of the same thing, so she may have had certain genetic problems. And it may be dietary related. It may be possible that they still haven't figured out the optimal diet to feed these animals in captivity. But I think the sense is probably she had some sort of genetic disposition.
In the Amazon, you discuss in your book this 25-acre island on dry land that's called the Reserve 1202. Tell us about that, and what are scientists learning from that?
Well, that's a really interesting project. So there are actually several of these reserves, I think 11 or 12. And what they are simply plots of rainforest, you know, in the Amazon north of the city of Manaus, where at a certain point back in the 80s, there was a lot of land clearing and burning of the forest that was taking place to convert the forest into ranch land. And an American scientist named Tom Lovejoy got this really interesting idea, which was, well, let's try to get the Brazilian government to allow us to establish these test plots in even amidst this land that's getting cleared and burned for farming. And we will have these stands of the rainforest that remain, and they'll be different sizes. And we are going to study what happens to them, because one of the, you know, sort of predictions that you would make based on sort of ecological theory, and you could also, you know, just say sheer common sense, is that as you cut the forest into these fragments of standing forest, the smaller the fragment, the less is going to be able to survive in it. And but let's test that. Let's see what happens. So they would do a, and they, and he got the Brazilian government to agree to that. So they would come in, they'd do this, they map off a plot, they'd do a huge census of what was in that plot, and then the forest would get cut down around it, and, you know, people would bring cattle in, and they would see what happened as the years went by. And that experiment has now been running continuously for 35 years, and it has shown that indeed ecological theory, you know, is correct, and the smaller the fragment, the less can survive on it, and that as time goes on, you find fewer and fewer species in these plots. So that experiment is a very, very vivid illustration of what happens when we fragment forests. So this phenomenon is called forest fragmentation. We leave some forest up, but we don't leave a continuous forest up. And in those little bits of forest, you know, species get marooned, and you suffer these local extinctions, so the species goes extinct in that little piece of habitat. Now, if it's still somewhere else, it's not extinct everywhere, but you can imagine that as we fragment more and more of the world, that it will lead to more and more, you know, globalized extinctions.
I think you point out also that as you move closer and closer to the equator, the diversity is greater, so obviously the species loss will be greater.
Yes, and that's a real you know, why is there so much concern about the rainforest as opposed to, for example, you know, Canada has a very huge expanse of what's called boreal forest. And that's a big forest, and it's a very important ecosystem. I do not want to, you know, devalue the importance of Canada's boreal forest. But if you simply look at how many species there are in that forest versus how many species there are in a, you know, comparable, you know, 1 acre of Canadian boreal forest versus 1 acre of Amazon rainforest, the figures are really phenomenal. You know, there's tens and perhaps hundreds of times as many species in an acre of rainforest because, well, no one is quite sure entirely why that's the case, but it is a pattern that's repeated, you know, all around the world, that species richness is much greater in the tropics than it is towards the poles.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Colbert about her book, The Sixth Extinction, which won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. So tell us about the frozen zoo, which I call humans cleaning up after human behavior.
Yeah, the frozen zoo is a really interesting place. The frozen zoo, the frozen zoo, it's a trademarked name, is actually is an outpost of the San Diego Zoo. And all it is, really, are some vats of liquid nitrogen, which, you know, freezes at a very, very low temperature. And in those vats are these tiny little test tubes, and in those test tubes are cell lines. So, you know, not embryos, not animals, but just, you know, living cells that can kind of be revived when they are taken out of the liquid nitrogen. They will divide again, but they are just one kind of cell, let's say. And the idea there is we should be preserving tissue from every species, really, that we can get our hands on, because we don't know what's going to happen to those species, and this may be eventually all that's left of them. And already that has happened to one of the species in that zoo. They only have about 1,000 species there now. One of them, the only, you know, material left from the species is in this liquid nitrogen. But there are also, I should say, other reasons for preserving, you know, tissue from animals besides as a sort of hedge against extinction. There's, you know, for research purposes. And so there's a lot of reasons, you know, why you might want to preserve tissue in liquid nitrogen. And a lot of places are doing it. The Museum of Natural History in New York has a big collection on ice, and there are institutions in England that have, the Cincinnati Zoo also has a big, what's called, you know, sort of cryobank. So a lot of places are now freezing tissue for all sorts of reasons, one of which is, you know, that we're losing species, and if not whole species, a lot of populations, and you might still want to have the genetics of those creatures even when you don't have those populations.
But you do seem to raise the question of whether or not this is really the best hope for the future of the species. I suppose you mean as opposed to actually working on moving back some of this human behavior that has changed habitat and things like that.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a very, very dangerous for us to believe. I mean, there's been a lot of talk lately. I'm sure many of, you know, your listeners have heard this conversation of, can we bring animals back, de-extinction? You know, if we lose the Sumatran rhino, can we save some tissue from the rhinos and eventually, you know, clone them and get another kind of rhino to carry them and give birth to them? I think it's very, very dangerous to start thinking that, well, once you wreck the diversity of this planet, you're going to be able to get it back. I think that's a pretty unlikely scenario, and we would be much better off, you know, preventing things from going to extinct than hoping for some, you know, sci-fi like cure that we're going to let all these things go extinct and then we're going to bring them back. I mean, among other things, the question arises: even if you could bring them back, you know, where are you going to put them if you destroy their habitat? So I don't really see that as a very useful alternative.
You cite the work of a group of scientists in your book who make a prediction. I think they did it in 2004. If this current extinction event continues at its current pace, how many species do they expect to go extinct?
Well, I think that, you know, that this gets back to, you know, as I said, the study that was just done the other day. I mean, the question of if you continue extinction rates at their current pace, you know, even just for a few centuries, you get to the level of, you know, a major mass extinction. So we're talking about, you know, once again, a few centuries can sound like a long time to people who don't live for a few centuries, but in a history of life kind of perspective, which is what I think it is important to bring to this issue, it's a very, very short time. It's like an eye blink. So, you know, if we continue at present rates, we get to very high numbers, you know, 50-75% of species, you know, within a matter, you know, in less than a millennium, let's say.
So just in case our listeners haven't picked up a tidbit here that would make them appear to be the best educated at a cocktail party, maybe you can tell us about is it the Anthropocene period? Did I pronounce that right?
Help us understand. There are different ways to pronounce it, but the Anthropocene, yes. The Anthropocene is this idea that humans are changing the planet so dramatically, sort of on a geological scale, that we have actually ushered in a new geological epoch. So technically we live in the Holocene, which is the period since the end of the last ice age, which was only about 12,000 years ago. So the Holocene is the period of, you know, of all of human civilization that's taking place in the Holocene. And now there's very serious debate among geologists. Have we entered a new epoch, which is defined and dominated and will leave behind a geological record of our presence, of human presence on Earth. And part one of the big signals of this, you know, epoch will be this extinction event, because obviously, you know, the fossil record will rather dramatically change.
Well, let's close on a comment made by anthropologist Richard Leakey, who warns in your book that Homo sapiens might not only be the agent of the sixth extinction, but also risks being one of its victims. Your thoughts?
I think certainly if you were choosing a time to live in, you know, you wouldn't choose to live in a time of mass extinction, because one of the points that I make in the book is, you know, times of mass extinction, the whole rules of survival seem to change, and a lot of very dominant organisms and groups of organisms get done in. So, you know, the fact that we are, you know, the dominant organism on the planet right now, the dominant species, does not necessarily protect us from the impacts of a mass extinction. But, you know, are we going to be among the victims of this extinction? I certainly, you know, don't want to claim to have any insight into that. We have also shown that we can live, even as a lot of other species are going extinct and their populations are plummeting, you know, and there are 100 Sumatran rhinos left, there are 7.3 billion people on the planet. So of all the species that do not seem to be in danger of extinction right now, you know, humans are close to the top of the list, probably at the top of the list. So I think you can answer that question a lot of different ways, and I don't know, you know, to be honest, what the most plausible scenario is.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and it's out in paperback. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.
Next week, Dan Hurley, author of Smarter, The New Science of Building Brain Power. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Brady Moore. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.